This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by the SANS Institute and hosted by SANS certified instructor Brandon Evans. And now, prepare for departure. We are cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Brandon Evans.
I am so happy to talk to Marquez Q. Sawyers, a senior manager of software engineering at Asurion. Q and I were both members of the Security Champions group at Asurion, which they call the Security Mavens. Q and I worked with each other while I was a developer, as well as when I transitioned to the security team. While Q has stayed on the software engineering side, he is a huge advocate for security transformation at Asurion. Q has his GSEC, GWAPT, GWEB, and most recently, his GCSA, the GIAC Cloud Security Automation Certification, associated with SANS Sec 540 Cloud Security and DevSecOps Automation. If you're a developer listening, I hope you'll find this conversation useful in determining how security can change and hopefully enhance your career. Q has also done a lot for the Nashville community. Q and I both participated in the 2018 Hack for the Community event, where we developed software for local nonprofits to solve problems that they otherwise wouldn't have the resources to solve. Beyond that, Q is an advocate and participant of a variety of development meetups in town. With that out of the way, welcome Q.
Hey, y'all. I really appreciate that, Brandon. Thank you for the introduction.
Most certainly. All well deserved. Now, to get started, I know you're a big advocate for Asurion's culture and development methodology. So for those who are not familiar with how things work in that organization, can you tell us a little bit about their approach?
Sure. So we call it the product team model here at Asurion. We adapted it from the Spotify model, but we're all small, self-encapsulated teams that are responsible for a specific portion of a customer's journey in the apps that we create. So our teams are made up of primarily between three to five engineers. We'll have a product manager who kind of acts as a liaison between the engineering team and our business. We'll have a designer that's responsible for our user experience, our user interfaces, interviewing our users, doing research on our users. Some teams might have a data scientist if the work is data intensive, but our whole thought process behind the way our teams are made up is that we don't want to have to wait on a decision to be made to move as a team. Like, we want to move quick. We want to fail fast. We want to be really close to our customers. So in being able to do all that, we want everything we need to be in a single team. And that way, we don't have to make decisions at boundaries. We don't have to wait on anybody. We can do anything that we need to do throughout the whole software development lifecycle, from starting with user research all the way to deploying our code, monitoring our code. All that stuff is encapsulated within our teams. And it just gives us the ability to move fast and really build things that our users want based on data. So that's kind of how we are over here at Asurion.
So one of the roles that is suspiciously, or maybe not so suspiciously, missing from that list are security folks. So how does security embed within those product teams?
Earlier you spoke about our Security Champions program, the Security Maven. So when you were first here, that program was really small. You might have one Security Maven per domain. I think you were the Security Maven for our domain. But since you've left, that program has really grown and exploded. So we're really trying to get a security maven in each one of those journey teams. But if you don't have a security maven in those journey teams, you have one pretty close in your domain. So we have that. We have security mavens embedded with everybody. We put everybody through training. We have meetings. That's one thing. But the thing that we've really been trying to do here of late is to really get security thinking embedded into what we do in our team. So we want our engineers to think like security people. We want our engineers to do, I always call it agile threat modeling. Well, we're threat modeling on the fly. We're threat modeling. We're thinking about the thing that we're building and how people can, you know, how people would be able to attack it or what people would try to do. And we think about that in our tech designs. We think about that in PRs. We just think about that throughout our whole development life cycle. So we're really trying to push that thought process into our engineers where you don't have to be a security expert to look at our stuff. You can kind of just, it's just a way of thinking, a way of being. Like, we want that to be a natural progression, just like testing, just like doing PR reviews. Like, security should be built into what we do. We're really trying to shift that left. Another thing that we do is, for a little bit more complicated things, that we have security coaches assigned to each team. So as a security maven, there's only so much you can do. There's only so much expertise you have, because you are an engineer, like a regular engineer. So if you need to reach out about something a little bit more pressing or a little bit more complicated, you're able to reach out to your security coach. You're able to quickly reach out to somebody from the security team and bring them on to kind of help you, help talk you through what you might need to be talked through, or help you through something that may be a little bit more complicated there. So a couple of different ways to handle security here in our product teams.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think that a lot of people listening will be really impressed with what you said about how there's really a security champion, a security maven for each of these small product teams, or they're at least trying to get to that point. Yeah. They may be saying that's unreal, because in their experience, it's hard to get one per organization. So what are some of the things that you think led to that explosive growth of the Mavens program? Was it that management was mandating that more people get involved, or did they take a different approach?
I think it started out with just the success of the Maven program and how people really bought into it. It started out with people like you, and then you kind of evangelizing the program to the rest of us. I think it really got people's ears perked up and really got people wanting to be involved in security. Like, when I first started as an engineer, to me, security was always a group of people that kind of told you what to do. And it was boring work that wasn't prioritized, that wasn't a fun feature. But, you know, when you and I think we were working on our video chat kiosk project, and you came on and did some, you know, you looked into what we had going on. And I just loved the interactions and the collaboration that we had together. So in that, I joined the program, and I think a lot of other engineers started to join the program, and we really started to get involved. We started to go to Capture the Flags. We got involved with Secure Code Warrior with that platform and did some stuff there. And I think as leadership started to see the wins that we were having, one thing that the manager, Mackenzie, of our program did really well was that she started these quarterly reviews where she would tout the progress that we were making and the things that we were doing and how much we saved the organization by having a set of security mavens. And I think that kind of made management, you know, made their ears perk up and say, well, we might need this for everybody. Like, this might be a good investment. So in that, a mandate came down that we kind of want a security maven in each one of these teams. So I think it was a two-pronged approach. It was the excitement that was drummed up about the program and the participation from the members, from the mavens, and then management seeing that participation and seeing how it was beneficial for the whole organization, and then kind of saying, well, let's go ahead and make this bigger and bigger and bigger. So I think it was a myriad of things that kind of led to that.
Absolutely. And for the security managers who are listening here, make security cool. Security is really cool. This is a very easy job for you all. And it seems like all too often people just do not make security cool. And once you do that, it's easy to get people involved, hopefully align incentives with both development and management such that developers can work on this cool area and learn more, as well as get promotions and get more financial incentives for doing security work, because their product leads also appreciate the work they're doing there.
Yeah. Make it a part of your culture and make it a cool culture. Don't make it a stuffy, throw it over the fence, you get it thrown back. We're big about collaboration here at Asurion. So the collaboration between the product teams and the security org kind of made that a natural, you know, it made the culture natural. It made it fun. I'll go have lunch with some of the security guys. I'll just talk to them in the hall. Like, the collaboration and the teamwork made it to where it's something that you want to be a part of and not something that you like loathe having to do.
Absolutely. So I know that most of Asurion, and especially your group, is cloud first in AWS. And leverages a lot of modern services, including, I know we were big into serverless technologies, which is where I really got involved with working with Lambda and also learning more about the security considerations regarding Lambda. So prior to joining Asurion, did you work with some on-prem technologies as well? Or are you one of the lucky folks like me who managed to spend most, if not all, of their career in the cloud?
So I have just a brief stint of my career with on-prem, where really hybrid. It started out as on-prem. So I worked for this company. It was called Splawn Award. It's called Centropy now in Birmingham, Alabama. We were a database marketing company, and we started out with some on-prem stuff, but kind of quickly after I got there, we started to migrate over to the cloud. And it was a guy there named, Spencer Bryant, who was really into AWS. And then I really hadn't heard of it. I was new. I was fresh out of college, and I really wasn't abreast of cloud technology and what it had to offer. So he really kind of brought me in and put me under his wing and really got me into that environment, really got me into that ecosystem, and taught me what I needed to know for cloud. So I started a little bit in the on-prem world, but it was a very brief stint. And I can't say that I did a lot of on-prem stuff. I helped a lot with the migration, and then we kind of got our services on in there, got our infrastructure on in there, onto AWS, and it kind of went on from there. So yes and no, a brief stint with on-prem, but not a whole bunch, just a little bit of SSH and restarting some services. That's pretty much it. I didn't do anything too crazy.
Yeah, that's no fun. I like to avoid SSH wherever possible.
Yeah. It can
lead to a lot of configuration drift as well as a lot of security issues as well. But as you were involved with that migration, what was exciting about that migration in terms of getting used to AWS services? What really made it pop for you?
It didn't seem as daunting as the on-prem stuff. So when I was onboarding with the company and he was walking me through like troubleshooting stuff and figuring out how to fix problems we may be having, or even just getting your code out there, like it seemed very daunting to me. I had to remember which server was which, where to go. You got to remember different credentials to SSH into machines. You have to remember to restart the service when you put your code on there. It was just it was real handsy, and it made me really nervous, especially being a young engineer. It kind of makes you a little trigger shy because you don't know if did I do this wrong? If something breaks, do I do it by myself? Do I wake up somebody in the middle of the night? Like those kinds of things. And migrating over to AWS kind of took a lot of that fear away because everything's in one place. You can kind of see what other people have already done and replicated. There's documentation out there to where you can go and learn best practices and stuff like that. And it makes it a little bit easier to have a sandbox to play in AWS. So it was easy for me to kind of go in my own time and really learn and really play around with things and break stuff and just see how stuff worked. Whereas with the on-prem stuff, like I can't say that I would have that same willingness to go out and really play around and try to do stuff. And then the services were cool. The way the services were, you know, compiled together and the kinds of things that they created just kind of makes you want to go. It's like you're a kid in the candy store. Like you want to go around and see what's out there, build new stuff, play with the services together. Like it kind of really energized me and really made me feel safe. Whereas an on-prem environment, I can't say the same thing.
And I want to get your take on the matter that you mentioned regarding having to manage some servers on-prem, whereas in the cloud, you have all of this centralization of your inventory and you're able to easily get into various systems. I find that a lot of companies that are migrating from on-prem to the cloud, they use that opportunity to initiate some kinds of DevSecOps practices. Yeah. But yeah. I've seen at the same time, in the cloud, instances where you have VMs that are special snowflakes that are given specific names, and as a result, they lead to all sorts of configuration drift. And I've also seen on-prem some DevSecOps kinds of solutions. Mm-hmm. I know that cloud is a huge enabler for DevSecOps, but do you really think it's one-to-one, or do you think it's possible to do DevSecOps or to do the opposite of DevSecOps in each of the environments?
I think there's always a possibility to do the opposite, but the thing about the cloud versus, and this is my, it just seems like the on-prem stuff is very opinionated and people have a very opinionated way of doing DevSecOps, to where I think you get a lot more best practice type stuff, a lot better recipes in the cloud. Like you have stuff to go and see, well, the industry leaders are doing this. And this is how they set their stuff up. So it makes the communication and the, you know, the authentic communication between the services in AWS make that DevSecOps portion of your work way easier. Like the things kind of naturally communicate with each other, or it's easy to get them to communicate with each other. Things like GitHub Actions make pipelines easier, and you can communicate. There's all kind of actions to help you communicate with your cloud infrastructure. So I would say, I think it's easy to get off track in both. You talked a little bit about people that migrate. And I think one of the things with migrating from on-prem to cloud is that there's some time that it takes to do it. And in that, you have to kind of prioritize what you're going to do during that time, because you have to keep the lights on. So it's real easy to go from on-prem to the cloud and then have some tech debt or security debt that you have to take care of. But at the same time, there's a lot of recipes. There's a lot of stuff out there for you to kind of speed that up. I can't say that was the case when we first made our migration. I think this might have been 2014, 2015. So a lot of the stuff that we have now wasn't there in place. So we did have some times where we had to kind of cut a corner here or there, do something brute force, or just do something that we didn't think was the best. But it was something that, we were a small shop, so it was something to keep us, get us started, keep us going, keep the lights on. But now, with everything that's out there, it just makes it real easy to build DevSecOps into what you need in your cloud environment.
So one of the core things related to DevSecOps is one of the things you mentioned, pipelines and capabilities like GitHub Actions. And there's similar things with Jenkins, TeamCity, or cloud native like Code Pipeline. But GitHub Actions is pretty popular because you're able to orchestrate various actions to happen whenever code is deployed in GitHub, which is what most people like to work with. One of the concerns that I have from a security perspective of these pipelines is oftentimes you're giving these pipelines so many permissions because they have to shape the environment that you're working in. They have to deploy code to your production environment. So how do you balance giving those pipelines the permissions that they need to do the work you need them to do, while also ensuring the principle of least privilege?
So that's interesting you say that. Like I've been with teams that have kind of not had the pipelines, and we had to do work to get to that point. They may have started out in Jenkins. They may have started out in something else, and we were migrating over to GitHub Actions. I always tell people, don't go out and grab a role that is already out there that works. Start out with a clean role, maybe find the least thing that you need to at least get the pipeline to start running, and let it fail. And as it fails, add the privilege that you need, and then it'll fail again and add the privilege that you need. Like, that's always my approach, because what I've been finding with some of the teams that I've joined lately is that they're not using least privilege, and we have to go in and get it to that point. And the reason that it gets to that point is because we have somebody that's, you know, we never want to reinvent the wheel. So if there's a role out there that already works, we'll go grab that role and plug it in, and we'll use that. But, you know, it has the keys to the castle. So I like to start from scratch and let the pipeline fail because it doesn't have the permissions. And then one thing that I like about GitHub Actions is that you can kind of start from where you failed at. Like, you don't have to wait for the whole pipeline to start over. You can start from where you fail, but I like to do my permissions in that way. Like, I'll let it fail and add a permission and add a permission till I get to a point to where it's successful. It's a little bit of work up front, but what I know I have is the least amount of privilege that I need, and I don't have the amount of privilege that another team needed or a team over here needed. Like, I'm not using a thing that they created on their own. I'm using something that I created, and I know that it has what it needs to be successful.
And I love that approach for two reasons. One is that the built-in policies that AWS has, as we mentioned in our IAM panel, which was one of the first episodes we have for this podcast, and I hope that people will go back and check that out as well. Those built-in policies are really bad because they don't specify the resource clause of what should be allowed, because AWS has no idea what resources are sensitive and what resources are not sensitive. The other reason I really like that approach is that people often try to go the opposite direction. They start off with a lot of permissions and then remove until things break and then pull back a little bit. But that work, generally speaking, never comes around, right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
People just delay and delay. They say, okay, that's for tech debt day or tech debt week. And you know, even that mindset of having tech debt or security debt in a particular allocated time, even that's kind of problematic.
That is problematic. It's interesting that you say that, because one approach that I've taken with my teams is that we don't prioritize tech debt or security debt as something separate from our work. It's a part of our work. So when we're prioritizing our work for the week or for our work for the 2 weeks, I'm always pushing my teams to say, hey, what security work or what tech debt work are we doing this week? Like, I don't like to push it off and push it off and push it off, because in that situation, what ends up happening is we have a security review coming up, or we have a CSO review coming up or something like that. And now we have to scramble or stay up or do all this stuff to get to a point to where we're comfortable with our posture, versus we kind of do this. We prioritize the highest priority security debt, the highest priority tech debt, and we'll grab, we'll have somebody, maybe it's the on-call person, work on that stuff. So our on-call person usually doesn't work on feature work. They're responsible for tickets that come in. They're responsible for tech debt and security debt. And that allows us to prioritize that work as a part of the work we do for that week. And then we kind of get to, you know, we get to sidestep that problem of having this big allocation, like, or this big set of tech and security debt that we have to kind of try to be heroes or boil the ocean and do it all at one time, versus, you know, we just do it as a part of the work we do every week. To me, that's an anti-pattern. I know a lot of people do it. I know a lot of people are like, we're going to do tech debt for 20% of our week or whatever. But usually what I see with that is that 20% is always allocated somewhere else. There's always a bug that comes up. There's always a little bit of extra work that needs to be done, versus if we can go ahead and prioritize that as part of the work we're doing for the week, we don't have to tote this security debt around with us. So that's the approach that I like to take to it.
Or on that one day that you've allocated per week to work on security debt or tech debt, people suspiciously spend a lot of time around the ping pong table.
Or it's the hot, it's usually a Friday. And it's usually the day, you know, people want to take off Fridays and Mondays or holidays or on Fridays, the weekend's coming up. People want to take off a little bit early, and you get in on Monday and it's, well, I didn't have quite as much time to do that work as I thought I had. So it's to mitigate that, we just go ahead and prioritize it as part of the work that we're going to be doing for the week.
Absolutely. So for a little bit more context, I know that not a whole lot of people are aware of Asurion, even though they're a humongous business. And those who are aware of them think, oh, that's who I process my phone insurance claims for. So can you share a little bit about what your team or your domain or your organization specifically is trying to build, and what your goals for that technology are?
Sure. So my domain is the My Asurion domain. So we're really interested in surfacing our products to our customers. One of the things that has traditionally been like a snag for us is kind of, like you said, people don't know what we do, and people don't know about all these cool services that we have out there. So the mission of our domain is, one, is getting surfacing these products and these things for exactly when our users need them, or anytime for that matter. And then as part of that, trying to surface stuff to our users quickly, we want our engineers to be able to build these things quickly. So we have a couple of platform teams that are responsible for time to market is what we call them. So they're responsible for helping us, helping our teams move a little bit quicker. And then the teams are responsible for kind of surfacing these products to our customers. So we're creating an account dashboard. We have a app that's responsible for surfacing our products and helping our users, you know, do claims or discover new services or chat with an expert with problems they may be having. So that's one side of it. And then I have a team that's Assuring UI. That's our pattern library team. So kind of trying to help our teams move faster and get a consistent brand across our teams is the mission of that team. I have another team that's my it's a photos product. So we're backing up your photos for you in the cloud. And we're using machine learning to find holidays for you, find trips you've been on, show those trips. Even if you want to search the photos or search like dog and find images with dogs in it, we have machine learning for that. So we have a myriad of technologies in our domain, but we're really wanting people to know how cool Assurian is, and that is just not cell phone insurance. There's apps like the Photos app. There's other services. There's security services. There's Wi-Fi scanning services. There are all these services that we have out there that we want people to know about and use to help them be successful in their everyday life.
Yeah, I was definitely very surprised to see all the products that were created there, especially now that you all have moved into the security space as consumer protection service as well. That's pretty cool. And I would definitely say that folks should check that out as well. And maybe we can put that in the show notes as well for promotional purposes. Yeah. But you just mentioned about how you want to make sure that your development teams are moving fast to be able to get these products to market. But then you also, a couple sentences ago, mentioned your security reviews and your CISO reviews. And typically speaking, like you said, security does slow things down at best, sometimes grind things to a halt at worst, especially when it comes to cloud-based teams that are so used to moving so quickly. Yeah. So we've all met at least one security professional that is all about no but instead of yes and.
Yeah.
So while omitting names to protect the accused, has security negatively affected your development processes? And if so, how?
So I won't say no. And I'll tell you why. Earlier I talked about the culture of security and the collaboration at Assurian, and it's the problem that I've seen with security teams and other organizations is they kind of feel like the police. They kind of feel like the vulnerability police or the security police, and I don't feel like that's the issue here at Assurian. Like, that's not what we get into. Now, they do tell us, like, that's a bad practice, or you need to work on that, or you need to fix that. But it's definitely a partnership. It's not, hey, this is broke, you need to fix it, and you don't hear from them until they check the vulnerability again. It's, hey, this is broke, here's some articles on how you could fix that. Here's some code that I've written. Here's a pattern that I've come up with. They're really good about that. And then another thing that kind of keeps us from screeching to a halt that I talked about earlier is that we build security into what we do. So it's not, we're not getting to our reviews and we have this big pile of security debt that we have to explain. We're getting to our reviews and we're showing them the progress that we've made from the last time we've talked. We're showing them that, hey, we've used a tool like Checkmarks and we've put that into our pipelines, or we use ColdQL and we put that into our pipelines. And it's putting us into a position to where we don't, those things don't creep into our code as much. We're shifting left and we're taking care of them before it's deployed. And then we don't have this debt that we have to go take care of right before the review. We're naturally kind of taking care of these things. Now, there is some stuff that squeaks through or sneaks through. But for the most part, we're catching a lot of those things up front. And the things that we don't catch, we're really prioritizing. We really have a plan to take care of those. And we're really being held accountable for not taking care of them. It's not like I'll do it and we can shoot somebody off. It's, hey, last time we talked about this, we don't want to see it on the next review. So we're really doing a good job with collaboration here between our product security teams and our product teams. And we're doing a good job of building security into our, you know, into our development life cycle to where we don't have to try to boil the ocean when it comes time to do one of those reviews.
That was a really nice answer. I want to talk a little bit more because although you know, I'm sure that the vast majority of folks are in that collaborative mindset. Let's make this easier. Let's go back in time before the Security Champions program blew up, before you really saw that level of transformation. So like right in the beginning of your time with Asurion, I'm sure there was one or two people that got in your way in some capacity with security. So we can pretend like they're no longer there. Give an example of that without naming.
Not necessarily Asurion, but in other companies. Because I wasn't, before the Security Champions, you know, really the first person from a security standpoint that I was involved with at Asurion was pretty much you. I was a new tech lead prior to being an individual contributor. I wasn't really, I was kind of insulated from that relationship. So the first person in security that I pretty much worked with was you. So, but if I take a step further back to other companies, I have ran into that, hey, you need to fix this and you need to fix this now. And this is terrible. And it, you know, really making you feel bad about something that you don't know. Like you can't, there's only so much you can know about security when you're not a security professional. And talking with the professional that makes you really feel bad about something that you've done and they don't prescribe anything to help you or they don't point you in the right direction, you know, that feels bad. And that's kind of what I've dealt with in the past. It's, hey, this is broken and fix it versus, hey, this is broken. This is what you can do to fix it. This is what some of the best practices are. I have ran into those things and it's been some late nights having to deal with some of that stuff. And it's usually, in the past, it has been when we were getting ready for audits and having to take care of some of that stuff for an audit or prior to an audit so we can come out looking good. It's, you have to fix all this stuff and it's just thrown over the fence and you have to fix it. And you go back to them to get your paper graded and then you get a D and you got to go back and start over again and you get your paper graded and you get a C+ and you kind of repeat that until you get an A. So that's kind of what I've dealt with in the past, but I can't say that I really dealt with that at Asurion, honestly.
And I think that's an important lesson that I keep trying to tell folks is don't attribute to malice to that you should attribute to a lack of knowledge, a lack of experience, because I guarantee you that these security folks, generally speaking, do not know what it's like to work in a fast moving development organization.
Yeah.
And yet they're expecting developers to know every single thing related to security. And that's just not the collaborative kind of approach that you really need to have. You need to explain issues so that people understand the business impact. And it's just so frustrating when people end up lecturing folks.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to give engineers a context. Like everything we do is based on context and based on a way of thinking. So that's the shortcoming of those security professionals, is like you don't give engineers the context that they need to make better decisions about this in the future. It's just like a, hey, were you trying to hide this? Or, hey, why'd you do this? Or are you cutting corners? And it's like, I'm not cutting corners, but I do have to prioritize the amount of time that I spend building this thing. And if I can't sacrifice my user experience over everything security. It has to be a balance in that. And I think one way to help achieve that balance is helping engineers think with a security mind and think about things from that mindset and it not be an afterthought. So that's one thing that I can say for all the security professionals out there that may look at this or may listen to this, is like, do a better job of passing that context down to your engineers and help them think the way that you think. And don't force feed them. Don't make them think in a matrix. Like, really help them think the way that you think. Really help them make decisions based on how you would make decisions. Teach them how to fish. Don't give them that security fish. Teach them how to fish. Teach them how to think the way you think. And I guarantee you see a little bit more progress in your security posture.
And remember, you're excited about security for one reason or the other. And it's probably because security is really cool.
Yeah.
It's so easy to sell. Security is cool. Take that opportunity to try to show them how much fun they can have working in this space and how important these things are. So definitely teach them how to fish, and they'll probably enjoy fishing so much that, like me, they'll become a full-time fisherman.
Yeah. Show them a cool exploit. Like, don't just tell them, hey, this can be exploited this way, or this is how what happens if you don't filter your inputs, or this is what happens if you don't give least privilege. Like, show them an exploit. Pull up a vulnerable VM, or pull up a vulnerable web app or something like that, and show them. That's way cooler to me. And that's one thing that you showed me. You showed me some of the vulnerable stuff that was out there. You showed me, invited me to some capture the flags, stuff like that. Like, that's what clicked for me. That's what made security cool. To me, it was just like, hey, here comes this guy telling me all this stuff that could potentially happen that will never happen. It's too hard for that to happen. But in seeing the way exploits happen or doing a capture the flag, you see that stuff and you're just like, this is not, you start to think to yourself, this is not as hard as I thought. And quite frankly, this is cool. It feels like you're kind of in a chess match with adversaries when you do it that way. And in turn, you know, it makes security cool, makes it something fun to play around with.
Yes, I definitely love playing cybersecurity chess. I wish I was as good at regular chess as I am at cybersecurity chess. But
I heard you're not too bad at regular chess either.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm in comparison to the amount of hours invested, I'm definitely worse than I should be. But that's a conversation for another time. So let's talk a little bit more about security tooling as well, because you mentioned a couple tools throughout. And you mentioned one tool that I wouldn't say I'm particularly fond of, which is Checkmarx.
Yeah.
And that's not even necessarily a slight at Checkmarx specifically, but more about static analysis in general, is you get so many false positives, which just end up being something that you spend so much time just reading through what actually matters. Yeah. So, number one, I'd like to get your take on static analysis and whether or not it provides that much value. But I'd also like to know which tools you do like, especially the tools that and the services that AWS provide.
Yeah. So that's interesting that you talk about Checkmarx, because the false positive review in and of itself is a job. Like, having to go and manage those. Like, we have a whole thing, a whole form at Asurion for managing false positives and getting rid of those. So I think static analysis is okay. It's kind of like a cold smell type thing, to where it's like, we can see us trending in the wrong direction. We can see kind of, it helps us identify bad patterns. I really like CodeQL. That's something that we've been using in our pipelines for, with our GitHub Actions. I'm liking that.
Can you talk a little bit about CodeQL for those who don't know?
CodeQL is just an analysis tool that's kind of built in. Well, I don't know if it's built in or if it's a plugin. I don't know that much about it. It was introduced to us by one of our security professionals. He added it into our pipelines, but it kind of, as a part of our pipelines, it shows us, hey, this is a problem that you have, and this is a bad code smell. This is something that you need to take care of. It kind of has a lot of stuff built into it, like secret scanning, static code analysis, different things like that. But it's built into our pipelines, and it's set up in a way to where we can't publish our code. We can't close a PR until we've addressed the things that come across from CodeQL. And I've been talking a lot about shifting left, and that's kind of one portion of it is, hey, CodeQL takes a look at what we're trying to put out there, and it kind of acts as a gatekeeper for us to keep some of that debt out of our system. But I can't say that I've read into it that deep. I did a little bit of work to get it into our pipelines. I go and look at their reports, but I haven't done anything deeper than that to look into it, honestly.
For sure. And there's all these tools, all these services that we use, and it takes a lot of work to investigate how they work underneath the hood. And that's, you know, something that I'd encourage security researchers to spend their time on, is just look at these services that your developers are using and try to understand what their strengths are, their deficiencies. And maybe the next time you work with a team and you're trying to get them onto static analysis, maybe you'll recommend this particular or newer capability instead of one of the more traditional tools. And what other types of security tools or AWS services do you have experience with or enjoy working with?
I've done a little bit of work with Burp. Before we like to use Burp prior to like doing our pen tests. So before we like have a team spend a lot of time on pen tests, we'll run through a burp scan to kind of try to figure out some low hanging fruit that we have that we can take care of. And it helps us spread out our security team a little bit more to where they're not spending as much time finding things that could have been found with the burp scan. So I like burp. I did a little bit. I can't remember which one of the SANS classes it was, but we did a lot of labs with the burp scanner. I thought that was cool.
Probably 542, the web application penetration testing class.
Yeah, the GWAP. Yeah, that was fun. Because that was my first time being exposed to burp and understanding what it could do. And what I like about it is that it kind of it helped transform my thinking about the way to attack stuff. Like automated attacking wasn't something that I thought about previous to taking the GWAP. But then I'm like, it kind of made me think about enumeration and how people could attack in that way. So that was another tool to put in my, I talked about agile threat modeling. That was another tool, another, you know, subject matter to think about as part of that. What else are we using? Sneak is another good one to look at our dependencies. I really like Sneak. It's pretty straightforward. Tells you what dependencies need to be updated. Dependabot kind of does the same thing. We have Dependabot built into our GitHub stuff. So those are a couple tools. We use Brinka, which is a security dashboard. So these different tools that I'm talking about, they all have an output associated with them. And sometimes it can be hard to look at those different outputs in isolation. What Brinka does is it brings all that stuff together and it gives us a high-level overview of what kind of security issues we're facing. So that's another tool that we've kind of been recently using is Brinka that I really like, just because it gives me that high level overview of the vulnerabilities that my teams are facing. I can drill down into them if I need to, but it kind of aggregates all that stuff together to give you a better security picture of what's happening.
Most certainly. And are you orchestrating or integrating these various tools with AWS in any way, or are they mostly standalone?
I think they're mostly standalone. I think we're doing a little, like there's some logging stuff that might go into it. Like we might add some logging from AWS, but for the most part, they're standalone. We have other stuff like the WAF tools in AWS, stuff like that, like the web application firewalls. We use those, some of the security that they offer there.
And from your experience, have you had a whole lot of false positives related to the WAF, or is that mostly blocked only malicious traffic? Like, in other words, has the WAF broken production in any?
No, the WAF, not that I can remember. I'm trying to think. I don't think the WAF has broken production. A lot of the management of the WAF is outside. That's kind of the cloud.gov org that does that. So, you know, that's a black box for me, but I can't say that it's ever broken production. For me. Now, we might have had some hiccups up front with as we were developing stuff, and we might push it to QA or dev, and then we might get a WAF thing there. But usually we're able to fix those before they get out to production, and they prove not to be problematic for us. Our CloudGov really does a good job of keeping that out of our way, keeping us safe with it, but at the same time, not making it a blocker.
Yes, and you mentioned the cloud governance team. Okay. I'd like to expose the listeners more to what role that team has within your organization, how they've enabled or affected security. So how do you interact with the cloud governance team, and why is there no cloud gov representative embedded in each of these product teams?
I think the reason that we don't have to embed is because cloud gov has done a really good job of automating the stuff that they do. There's some scanning that happens in the background. So they're looking for tags. They're looking for overly permissive IAM roles. They're looking for infrastructure that isn't created based on our best practices. So a lot of that work is automated, and you'll get an email, and it'll even go as far as to delete that infrastructure if it's not. They'll give you an hour. They'll say, hey, you need to fix this in the next hour. And if it's not fixed, it'll actually delete it. So to your question of why that person isn't embedded, I think they've done a really good job of automating that work. And I think they do a really good job of, you know, really enforcing best practices. That's what I really like about it, is because, you know, as engineers, sometimes we can get into a rush and we'll create something that's not created in the best way. And then in engineer fashion, we have to move on to something else because another big problem comes up and that thing is left out there. And it becomes an attack vector for somebody looking to attack us. So CloudGov and their automation kind of keeps us safe in that way, is that it keeps us honest because it's like, hey, you should be creating these things in that way. And if you don't, I'm going to delete it. But at the same time, we're kind of able to see those best practices in action. They're not just telling us we're going to delete this thing because it's not created correctly. They're telling us we're going to delete this thing because the IAM values are overly permissive, or it's not tagged correctly. So it doesn't know, we don't know who it's belonged to. So it's two things. It keeps us safe and it kind of tells us, it reiterates those best practices for us. And I really liked it.
This story's making me smile because we talk about in Sec 540, as well as a variety of other courses, as well as just in general in the industry, we talk about gates versus guardrails and how you should allow people, developers, to move forward as long as you're checking for things that go wrong, instead of having a gate where you have to go through this particular check in order to release. But the way that the cloud governance team works, based on the way you're describing it, is it's kind of like they're a militant guardrails organization. Whereas if you get past the guardrail and go onto an uncharted path, they may detonate your car. Goodbye infrastructure. And I'll admit, because I've worked with that organization before in the past as well, and I had a complete 180 turnaround in terms of how I thought about them, is that you really got to educate folks that you're going to do those kinds of militant actions in response to these bad practices, because I would just keep seeing my virtual machines get destroyed and I wouldn't really know why. But that's why you really, in my opinion, I'd love to get your take on this. You really need to explain this on onboarding, that, hey, here are our practices. Here is the list of all the practices. If you do not follow these practices, hey, that's fine, but it's going to live for 1 hour.
And I can say that it has caused a couple extra hours of debugging in the past with, I missed the email, I wasn't paying attention to it. And now I'm using API Gateway. I'm trying to hit an API. I'm debugging this thing and I don't realize why it's not working. And I'm spending time really debugging down a different path. And the main reason that it's not working is because it doesn't exist anymore. So I've had those hiccups in the past, but you know, as it kind of happens to you a couple times, in your mind, you're like, let me go check my email to make sure CloudGov didn't delete this. But honestly, what it did for me is like, let me go ahead and add my tags in here. Let me go ahead and do the things that CloudGov wants me to do so I don't have to deal with this. It makes my infrastructure more resilient and more safe. And it just, you know, it puts those, like you said, those guardrails around you. But I think it really transforms your thinking, because nobody wants to create that piece of infrastructure again. So it kind of smacks you on the hand and says, do it right the first time and you don't have to worry about any of this.
Well, it took about 45 minutes, but I finally got you to admit that sometimes security can slow things down. But I appreciate you taking the responsibility and, you know, saying, hey, that's not really their fault. That's the fault of people missing certain things. And hey, you know, we can collaborate. We can ensure that these practices are, in fact, best practices, and also flag things that are overly locking down our infrastructure while still making sure that we have those guardrails in place. So they have a role to play. Development has a role to play. We just got to play nicely.
Yeah, we got to play nicely, and we got to, you know, it's a social contract. We got to accept what we signed up for. We got to accept that, hey, we want to be good stewards of our code bases and good stewards of our infrastructure, and these people are here to help us do that. And in turn, we kind of have to do what they say a little bit. And it's a symbiotic, mutualistic relationship, to where we're better together. And it's not a battle. It's not a CloudGov versus the product team. It's really a collaborative effort. And if we do it right and really pay attention to it, then it makes everybody better at the end of the day.
Awesome. Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap up. So before we do that, though, Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the local initiatives that you've helped to promote and organize to help get people involved with software engineering who maybe did not have that background going in?
Sure, sure. So I'm really big into diversity in our space. And it's because I think there's a myriad of people that use the products that we build. And it does us a disservice if the people building these products only look a certain way. Just because there's a wide array of people that use these products, we want the people building them to look like the people that are using them because it helps us. So one thing is here at Asurion, we have ERGs, employee resource groups, that act as support for different sets of employees. So one of those resource groups that I'm a part of is BEST. It's Black Employees Support and Talent. Part of the recruiting team, the recruiting chair here. So we just went out to Fisk and did some recruiting. In the past, we've went out to places like Howard University and did recruiting. We've went out and spoke to the National Society of Black Engineers, the chapter over there at Vanderbilt. We've done some work there. So that's one thing. Another group that I'm a part of is called the Black Codes. And it's supposed to be a safe space for Black engineers. It's a place for us to get together. It's a place for us to seek out help. A lot of the people in the group are new, up-and-coming engineers. And you know the hiccups that kind of come along with it, the learning the code, the nuance of engineering. So that's a group that's just kind of to support Black engineers here in the Nashville area. It started by a guy named Calvin. He's really sharp. I really love what he's doing there. Another one is Blacks in Technology. It's more of a global organization that I've recently come across. I really like their mission of just helping kids, helping individuals get introduced to tech. So they have a program at Republic High School where they're teaching kids how to code. They do a lot of different things. They have a conference that they do every year. So I really love that group. I'm interested in working a little bit more with them. Another group that I really like what they're doing is Pivot Tech, Pivot Technology. They're a coding school that's geared towards underrepresented minorities. They've really been shaking things up. They have contracts with people like Shift, with people like Amazon. They're really trying to get people into programming through teaching them, through a coding boot camp. And then they're doing a really good job about getting those people jobs after they get out of their program. And they're even going into companies and upskilling their workforces within those companies and helping people go through like apprenticeship style programs where maybe you're a frontline worker, but you end up being an engineer. So those are just a couple of the organizations that I've dealt with directly or indirectly, but I'm really liking their missions and really excited about what they're doing in the Nashville area and abroad.
Excellent. And it's so important to get those multitude of perspectives as well as encourage folks that maybe did not think that based on their background that they would want to get involved with technology to show them that this opportunity exists and that absolutely everyone is capable of doing it if it's something that's interesting to them, regardless of your background, regardless of your socioeconomic position. I think that's awesome stuff.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you having me.
Most certainly. Before we drop for the session, do you have any information about where people can find you online?
Sure. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'll drop it in the notes. I'm on LinkedIn. Reach out to me there if you have any questions, if you want to bounce ideas. If you're looking for a mentor, I can give you a little bit of my time. That's one of my favorite things to do is mentor and grow engineers. So reach out to me there. Just hit me up on LinkedIn. I'll drop it in the notes here.
Awesome. And I love that you're mentoring folks. And I just don't know how you find the time in the day because you're working on your development work, learning more about security, being a newly minted cloud ace, and also mentoring folks. I mean, that's a lot. But at the same time, it's so rewarding. You learn so much by teaching, I find.
It is. It's energizing. And I try to make sure I keep a piece of my day to do that portion, to mentor, because it's energizing. On the days when I might not feel like coming into the office, if I know I have a one-on-one conversation coming up, those are the kinds of things that get me out of the bed in the morning and get me onto I-65 South to get down here to the Gulch Hub. So I love it.
That's awesome. Well, I really hope that folks will reach out to you and hopefully learn a lot from you about development, DevSecOps, as well as security. And as always, for folks who are listening and are looking for some more of those free resources that are out there regarding cloud security, always check out sans.org/cloud. Maybe check out Sec 540 and get your GCSA so you could be a cloud ace like Q. But with that being said, Q, it was great having you on the podcast.
Great talking with you. See y'all.
All right. Take care.